the areas of higher education, there has emerged a discipline known by various names, Religionswissenschaft, comparative religion, history of religions, the study of religion, or more commonly, religious studies. This discipline is a relatively, therefore, new phenomenon, follows the canons of established scholarship, particularly in the social sciences and in the humanities. It has at least two objectives, as I see it, one being the attempt in higher education to fill the void in the study of the human condition by bringing into that study something of the religious aspect of life. And it also has the goal of being able to do that in ways that are honest and objective and straightforward with that which it is studying. Religious studies has also emerged, interestingly, in areas other than the traditional home for the study of religion, namely sectarian schools or universities, so that you find this discipline particularly prominent in the United States in public universities, even more so than in the private church-related schools. Of late, religious studies is taking a kind of a different additional task, beginning to look at the consequences of the study of religion for the wider political and social world, trying to ask questions about truth claims and resolving truth differences in regard to the various religions of the world. In all of these areas, Professor Ninian Smart has been a major figure in the establishment of that discipline. In fact, his career in some sense parallels the establishment of religious studies as a field. He's trained in philosophy. He studied under J.L. Austin, who is a major philosopher at Oxford University, in philosophy. He's studied also and is an authority also in sociology, particularly in the sociology of knowledge. He is an area specialist in certain areas such as Christianity, Christian studies, Indian religions, certain forms and aspects of Buddhism in Southeast Asia. He has written, by my count at least, more than 20 books. I want to mention a few of them. The Religious Experience of Mankind is in its third printing and is a major textbook in the field. He was a academic consultant, the major authority in the BBC production of a 13-part television series on the religions of the world called The Long Search that was aired a number of years ago and then I think repeated a year or so ago on PBS. And he's written a book by that same title that came from that work. He's written a book entitled The Phenomenon of Christianity. One of his latest textbooks is called Sacred Texts of the World. He has a book entitled Doctrine and Argument in Indian Philosophy, The Philosophy of Religion, The Phenomenon of Religion. He gave recently the Gifford Lectenborough, and those were published as a book entitled Beyond Ideology. Is one of his most recent titled Worldviews, and the one that came out just last year is entitled Religion and Politics in the Contemporary World. Both Ninian and I are just returning from an international conference on comparative philosophy that was held in Hawaii, sponsored by the Society for Asian and Comparative Philosophy, and he gave one of the major keynote addresses at that conference. I've known Ninian for a long while and consider him a colleague and a friend at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He teaches there as well as at the University of Lancaster. I have only one kind of personal complaint. The last time that I introduced Ninian was several years ago at a small college in Maine, Brunswick, Maine, called Bowdoin College. And I was teaching there and had assembled a group of students and faculty, and we met each week and viewed one of the episodes of The Long Search and then would view it together and then would discuss it. And I knew, of course, of Ninian's involvement in the production of that series, and so I asked him if he would come to Bowdoin and address our group, which he did. This was in the middle of the winter, well below zero, and he showed up in the evening to that crowd dressed in his full-fledged Scottish regalia, wearing his kilt and all of his proper accoutrements, and I'm only disappointed that he didn't do the same thing tonight. But it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Ninian Smart, whose paper is entitled The Relevance of the Study of Religion to World Affairs. Professor Smart.
Well, thank you for those kind words of introduction, and it is for me a great pleasure to be here in Salt Lake City. I've long wanted to visit here, and this is my first opportunity. I hope not my last visit to this noble city, of which, of course, Dr. Bradford is a prominent son. And, of course, you're well aware that many of the Mormon converts who came over here were Scotsmen, so that's a good sign. My favorite American Indian proverb is the proverb, mind you, it's the only American Indian proverb that I know, but still, it's my favorite. It is, never judge a person until you have walked a mile in his moccasins. Never judge a person until you've walked a mile in his moccasins. And what I want to talk about in the first part of this paper is walking in other people's moccasins. Or if you prefer it, standing in other people's shoes or imagining what it's like to be somebody else. In other words, I want to discuss the importance of the study, of the nature of the study of religion and religions, and more generally, worldviews, whether religious or non-religious. My occupation is in education. I believe that the study of religion is one of the most important areas of education. But it's so for a reason that is often unfamiliar to religious people. We are, I think, mostly used within religious traditions and denominations and so forth to what might be called religious instruction. That is to say, the handing on of what is taken to be truth in the community and the handing on of the values of the community through religious instruction. However, the study of religion is different from this and exists in a certain way at a different level. It's concerned with trying to describe what happens in religion, what is the power of religious ideas. We are often, when confronted with religious ideas, first of all thinking about whether they're true or not. But I would be grateful if for a moment you'd forget truth and value and think about only the power of religious ideas and activities and experiences. For religion, obviously, has had tremendous power in human history. It is not an exaggeration to say that the major civilizations themselves are built upon the scaffolding of the religions which have formed them. Two areas of civilization and human life are developing in the world today. It is on the basis of new worldviews which have emerged. What would human history have been like without the life of Christ, or the life of the Prophet Muhammad, or the life of the Buddha, or the life of Confucius, and so on? So religion has tremendous power, and I want to discuss issues that are connected with the power of religion and why we need, therefore, to study this area of human experience and activity in ways that are appropriate to it and without bringing necessarily our own faith or prejudices or ideas to bear in trying to uncover what it's like to be other people. For let's face it, most of us, most of the time, are dealing with people who have somewhat different values and experiences from our own. And it's important for education then to use imagination in trying to step into the moccasins of others. This is so not only in the field of religion. I would remind you that approximately half of us are female and half of us are male. And it's not altogether easy for males to understand what it's like to be female, and conversely. Yet our education doesn't give us much help, by the way, in trying to exercise our imaginations. But it is important that we should do so. So I want then, in the first part of what I have to say, to talk about the power of religious ideas and the way in which we may come to estimate religion, quite irrespective of whether we believe those religious ideas to be true or false. But let me now, before going on to how we study religion and why it's important for understanding the world as a whole, let me just give you a few instances of the power of religious ideas, which would introduce to you, of course, the thought that we need to understand these things in order to cope with the shrinking world in which we find ourselves. Recently, U.S. Marines were in Beirut, and they were shooting at people and getting shot at by people and were blown up by people and so on and so forth. We know all the melancholy tale of the miseries of the Lebanon. Some of the time they were being shot at by Druze. Now, I went around during that period when U.S. Marines were in Beirut asking people, who are Druze? What's a Druze? Or what are Druze, perhaps? Some people thought that it was a plural of Drew. One Drew, several Druze. Nobody knew what Druze were because nobody had ever been taught this kind of thing in school. But nevertheless, they entered into the political equation. While we're on the subject of Islam, I only have to mention the name of the Ayatollah Khomeini as one of the major forces in the world, though incidentally little understood still in the West. But somebody whose ideas and the ideas of his followers, these ideas we need to understand if we are to have any grasp of the politics of that area. Another example of the power of ideas is this, if you're in Germany, as I was a couple of years ago, and go from, let us say, where I was, Göttingen, in the central part of Germany, if you go about 15 miles out of town, you come to the frontier with East Germany. That frontier has barbed wire, it has mines, it has machine guns, and other appurtenances of frontiers where there is an effort to keep people in East Germany. Now, why are people kept in East Germany? Why are books censored in the Soviet Union? Why in many totalitarian countries do they not have freedom of speech? Why is it dangerous for people to express opposition to the regime? The answer is, the regime fears, among other things, ideas. There's no greater testimony to the power of ideas than the censorship which has afflicted many societies, not only, of course, modern communist societies, but many societies in the past, as though ideas themselves can be dangerous. Another instance of the power of ideas, of course, would be the work of Mahatma Gandhi, the most, in a general sense, the greatest Christian of the 20th century, who deeply influenced, of course, Martin Luther King, who himself was influenced not just by Gandhi, but also by Martin, as his name testifies, and various other elements in the Christian tradition, and whose movement was such a cause of change in modern America. I spoke to Dr. Bradford earlier, and I was saying that, the easiest thing for me to do in expressing the power of ideas is simply to point around this very hotel, to this very city, which is a testimony itself to the power of ideas in forming a new community. Not only religious ideas have been dynamic, but also, of course, other worldviews, secular worldviews. The plenary session this afternoon discussed some of the ways in which secular ideas are expressed on television and through the media, and they certainly have a powerful grip upon us. So, in order to understand our world, it seems important that we should be able to understand human beliefs, human religious experience, and so on. How do we do it? How do we attempt to understand what it's like to be a Muslim in Iran, or a Baptist in Louisiana, or a Presbyterian in Scotland, or a communist in Romania? What is it like to be these people? We have to have some grasp on that if we are to understand what it is that makes these societies function. For societies themselves, in part at least, only in part perhaps, but in part reflect the religious commitments and religious experiences and practices of the people in them. So then, how do we involve ourselves in this study, which is so often kind of cross-cultural, moving, as it were, from one culture to another? I think the most important thing for us to reflect on is that we must get behind the surface. Very often the ideas of another religious tradition or religious belief system may seem alien to us or peculiar. We may not be very sympathetic, let us say, to Catholic tradition. But what is it that lies behind the practice of the Catholic Mass? What are the valuable things which the Catholic herself or himself draws from those rituals? And I think one important key to getting inside other people is, as I say, the use of imagination, or if you like, the use of empathy, to try and feel with other people. I want a little later in the second part of the lecture then to move on from the exercise of empathy to the exercise of judgment, questions of value which come up. But first of all, in order to understand human phenomena, human activities, we need to understand what it is, feels like to be human, what it is to be one of these people whom we contemplate. And the use of empathy is important because it means, as the name implies, feeling with other people, trying to feel what it would be like to be in somebody else's shoes. And often, of course, that brings with it the need for information. Often our schools, and not only high schools, but also colleges and universities, but often our schools leave people remarkably uninformed about other people. To take two examples that have happened to me. I was once in Miami Beach and I happened to bump into an Englishman who was on holiday there, and he was in a very nervous condition. His hand was shaking because he was wanting to smoke a cigarette. So anyway, he managed to get some cigarettes and he lit up this cigarette, and he said, "The first cigarette of the day." And I said, "What's the matter?" "Well, it was a Sunday, as it happened." And he, "Well, I'm staying in this crummy Jewish hotel," he said, "and they got big notices all over the place saying no smoking on the Sabbath." So, I inquired what he'd been doing the previous day, and of course he'd been smoking all day, so I gently told him the terrible truth that the Sabbath, the Jews, is on a Saturday, and he'd never heard of that before. Now, he was actually a well-educated Englishman who was director of one of the major electrical companies in the United Kingdom. So I thought that's a bit staggering that his education had not even informed him of that. But it could be much worse. I showed once one of these films that Dr. Bradford referred to, a film on Islam, to a couple of hundred students in Santa Barbara at the University of California. And afterwards I asked them whether they'd ever seen a film before on Islam, or whether they'd seen a television program on Islam, or maybe read a book on Islam, or maybe read a chapter of a book on Islam, or maybe had an hour's instruction on Islam, or at least had read something on Islam. And only four people put their hands up, three of whom looked suspiciously like Iranians. So I said to them, "Now, what kind of education do you think you're getting that one of the major civilizations of the world you know nothing about? Moreover, a civilization that happens to be sitting on the very oil that you're using in your automobile." That people could come to the age of 19, they were intelligent people, at least I think they were intelligent people because they were at the University of California, and they were just intelligent young people, and they were totally ignorant, except for one of them and those three Iranians, about anything to do with Islam. And no doubt it would have been worse with Buddhism, but even in my experience, knowledge of Judaism or any other form of Christianity than the form that they might or might not have been brought up in is rare. Because, of course, our education system tends to screen out the study of religion at the school level. It's not just, of course, the United States. Most countries leave people extremely ignorant about the religions of any other group. And if, as was being discussed last night, there are prejudices against the Mormons among some people, like evangelical criticism, evangelical Christians of a certain kind, don't be too hard on them. They really are extremely ignorant. And maybe it's not entirely their fault, but the fault of our education system. So information is important, and empathy is important. We need in understanding others across cultures particularly, but even within our own society, to know a lot in the way of a certain amount of history and so on. And we need also, in studying religion, to be able imaginatively to enter into the thoughts and feelings of others. Feelings, perhaps, above all, because obviously religion has a lot to do with experience. In fact, I'd say that in order to understand a religion, you need to understand it in its different dimensions. Often we concentrate, as this conference perhaps rather often does, on matters of doctrine. But there's also the narrative dimension of religion, the stories which underpin religion, that is to say, the historical events and so on that are believed in, that underpin religion. There are the moral values or moral teachings or ethics as a third dimension. There are the rituals of religion, without which many of the doctrines and narratives make no sense. There are the social institutions of religion, but above all, there is the set of experiences that go with religion, the feelings and experiences that we have to enter into, however dimly, in trying to deal with the nature of a religious tradition. So I'd say that the study of religion is something which attempts not to worry over much about the truth or otherwise of what you're concerned with here, but what it means to human beings, and therefore the power it has to shape human society. That approach to the study of religion is something which is especially important, of course, in the contemporary world, not merely because of the examples that I referred to, but also because our own societies, wherever we are in the world, are getting increasingly plural. The second largest Greek city in the world is Melbourne, Australia. The largest Polynesian city is Auckland, New Zealand. I, for a time, lived in Birmingham, England, where there are many immigrants from Ireland, India, Pakistan, and so on, and they say that the typical inhabitant wears a shamrock in his turban. Los Angeles is the largest multi-ethnic conglomeration in the history of the world. Now, you might, of course, everybody writes off Los Angeles as anomalous, but actually it's the wave of the future, that all the cities of the Western world are getting increasingly complicated with different groups living together. Not always with friendship, but living together. And so it is, I think, increasingly important in our shrinking world that we should have the capacity for the study of religion. Indeed, I would go further. I would say that the study of religions in the plural, in this kind of empathetic way, imaginative way, which involves being informed and trying to be fair, impartial, and sensitive in looking at other people's beliefs, that kind of study should be a routine part of high school education. However, of course, there are always problems when you mention religion. And religion becomes a political football, as we know, kicked around by the politicians. There is at present time much evidence, of course, of this, not only in the United States, but in the United Kingdom and in other countries. The question of religious education and so forth has come a little to the fore. In a way, though, what we need to study is not just people's religions, but also what may be more broadly considered their worldviews. I recently wrote a book called Worldviews, as Bedford was saying, mainly with a view to broadening approach in some respects in the study of religion to the study of secular worldviews as well as religious ones, because they're also important, and because, above all, our religions are often, in any case, not pure religion. In the 200 years since the French Revolution, probably the most important force in the history of mankind has been nationalism, the idea of the nation state, the sovereignty of the nation. Every part of the whole world now, except the Antarctic, has been carved into nation states. And primary loyalty that people feel is often to their nation. I was wearing a kilt out of nationalism. Actually, the proudest boast of Scottish nationalism is that Scottish nationalism hasn't done anybody any harm, except possibly the Scots. Nationalism is a very powerful force in the modern world, one of the controlling ideas. And itself, as the secular rituals of television and of national events as shown on television, themselves a kind of religion, as was demonstrated in the plenary session after lunch today. And so it's often the case that, just for starters, that people's religion is also identified with their national heritage. You often have a blend of religion and nationalism. Blend of religion and nationalism is very powerful in Ireland, powerful in Cyprus, powerful in Lebanon, very powerful in Sri Lanka at the present time, powerful in India, and in all those countries, incidentally, there is trouble between ethnic groups. So we've got to recognize the fact that often we are relating our religion, our religious tradition, whatever it may be, and I might in the discussion reveal what my religious tradition is. Whatever our religious tradition is, it's often mixed up with something else, and of course mixed up with secular values. When Ronald Reagan says that he is a Christian and that he's leader of the free world, then his total worldview, if he's right about what he's saying, is a Christian, liberal, or something, democratic view, which is his total worldview. So if we examine our own selves and say, what is my worldview? We will say, I am, let us say, a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I believe in democracy and various other things. So that in order to be realistic, we have to extend our analysis of human ideas that move us beyond religion as narrowly considered, and therefore I sometimes use the word worldview, the word worldview, instead of religion, which helps on aeroplanes. One of the crosses that you have to bear if you teach religion, as I do, in the way in which I teach religion, I'm sure Dr. Bradford would add his testimony to mine, is that you're sitting in an aeroplane quietly doing nothing when your neighbour says, what do you do? And then you say, well, I teach, nervously. Where do you teach? Well, at the University of California. Oh, how interesting. What do you teach? Well, religious studies. And he says, well, what do you think about Seventh-day Adventists? And then you say, well, as a matter of fact, I don't know anything about Seventh-day Adventists. He says, what are you doing teaching at a university, like University of California, teaching religion, you know nothing about Seventh-day Adventists. So that's miserable. But now I say, they say, what do you do? And I say, well, I teach at the University of California. What do? Worldview analysis. And they say... He says, that sounds interesting. What kind of thing do you do with that? I say, well, suppose you want to understand what it's like to be a Seventh-day Adventist. How would you go about it? How would you find out what the beliefs are and what it feels like and all that stuff? So, in a way, our study is wider than the study of religions. I think the study of worldviews that move human beings. So that's what I mean by studying worldviews and religions, and of course one of the things that we wish to know is, are they powerful? To what extent do they influence people, and so on? And that of course is a second part of that study is trying to estimate what are the really dynamic worldviews and religious ideas and so on and so forth in the contemporary world. And as we know, there are lots of new religious movements, for instance, and always have been. There are 10,000 new independent Christian churches in Black Africa, for instance. And since I started talking, a new one has probably been founded. The whole world, I had a student who wanted to work on new religious movements in London, and I asked him to draw out a square mile of London and just look at what's inside in the way of new religions. And he took Mayfair, which is a very expensive part of London, and somewhat sinful as well, and he found 47. And so I said, well, stop looking, it's getting, you know, embarrassing. So many, and of course we may take, I've been a little light-hearted in saying this, but every one of those religious movements, and every religious movement in the world, and every worldview in the world, is itself, in part, the answer to some human problem and human question. They are all the consequences of human beings having hopes and fears and attitudes that they must come to terms with. I've never, therefore, felt very happy about those who've sneered at the so-called cults. They may be dangerous in certain ways, that's a value judgment, but every one of them that recruits human beings who have questions, needs, desires, and we must respect those human beings. Actually, privately, getting to value judgments, I often think the followers of some new religious movements are better than their gods, but that's by the way. So then, I regard this as an important ingredient in our understanding of the world. I now want to go on to a somewhat different area, not just the question of description, but what values arise from this kind of study almost automatically. What intrinsic values, so to say, result from the process of trying to get into other people's minds and souls? Well, I think the very fact that we may be involved in this, which I regard as a very noble human endeavor to try to find out what it's like to be another human being, behind that, or involved in it, is a desire to understand, a desire for fairness and objectivity. Also, that film, that movie that was shown last night, betrayed no desire whatsoever for fairness and objectivity, and therefore, even as propaganda, I would think to be almost entirely useless. That may be underestimating the power of misunderstanding in this world. But we, if we are honest in the educational effort, and I believe if we're honest from a religious point of view, have no wish to, if we are in argument with somebody or debate with somebody of a different persuasion, have no desire to misrepresent that other persuasion. That we need to be fair in the very act of desiring to understand others. That itself, of course, is a social value. And I think it leads almost inevitably towards, rather than away from, a tolerant society. And it leads us towards the view that if we are to change the minds of other people, as sometimes we feel we are moved to do, we must do it by persuasion. And so, and not by force, that is to say. And so I think this kind of education itself does move us in the area of values towards toleration and fairness, and therefore the values of this kind of search are the values of what may be called the open society. And yet, of course, it's been a constant temptation in many societies, constant temptation for religions and ideologies to close society, to make sure that uncomfortable and different opinions are not held. But I think that one of the very great blessings of the United States, if I may say so, a blessing not quite shared by Britain, is the notion of society in which state and church are kept apart. I would go further. I would say all worldviews as institutionalized and the state should be kept apart. That is to say that it should not be that no citizen should be under any penalty because she or he believes this or that or the next thing, whether it be political or religious or both. But certainly I think an open society is one which is favorable to the kind of study that I mentioned. And it is no coincidence that the United States is the greatest of the pioneers, not the only pioneer, but the greatest pioneer in this field of the open and plural study of religion. And I think there are problems in any case for closed societies and closed religions and closed ideologies. But I would add that we mustn't duck the fact that a sincere attempt to understand other great religious traditions, whether they're close to us within the Christian fold, let us say, or far away from us, such as Buddhism or Islam, we mustn't duck the fact that it does raise, they raise, often uncomfortable questions for our own faith. Somebody once said the comparative study of religion makes people comparatively religious. Well, that's not actually true in my experience, but it does, there is a gray of nevertheless. It's difficult it changes your religion, let's put it this way. That the very act of involving ourselves with other people and other people's beliefs changes our own faith, it's bound to, whatever that may be. The atheist who encounters the noble Buddhist is changed. The Christian who meets the compassionate Muslim is changed. The Catholic who meets the sincere Marxist is changed. That we're bound to be altered by the company that we keep. And after all, the very act of studying religion in this way is the attempt to hold up mirrors to other religious traditions. And in holding those mirrors, we enable people to meet those traditions and those religious figures that they otherwise would not meet. I was involved in that series about world religions. So when I was involved in that, I had an aged aunt in Scotland who's the widow of an uncle of mine who was a Presbyterian minister, and she's a fine person. And she saw a film on Buddhism that we'd done, and she said to me afterwards, she wrote me a letter and said, I never realized there was such goodness in Buddhism, and I'm very pleased about it. Now, of course, many religious people, unfortunately, would take the opposite view. They'd become frightened of the fact that there's goodness in Buddhism. But she was a good person, I think, who had this generous attitude that if other people have virtue, that's good news. Not bad news. Many Christians, unfortunately, feel threatened. You know, that if there's good, you know, if Buddhists are all that good, then doesn't it somehow affect the uniqueness of Christianity? The answer is, well, it does affect the uniqueness of Christianity, but you should be cheered by the thought that there are secret Christian values elsewhere in the world, not just in the Christian tradition. But it is a challenge to religion. There's no doubt that the study of religions in the plural represents some kind of challenge to traditional thinking. But traditional thinking has to come to terms with it anyway, because God made a world in which there were many different religions. And he didn't make a world, so far as I can see, in which the adherents of other religions than Christianity were actually thoroughly evil or miserable or what have you. He made a world in which good people, productive people, creative people belong to different religious traditions. And for some people, that's a disturbing thought. But it's something that every religion has to come to terms with. every religious tradition. Islam has to come to terms with it, Christianity has to come to terms with it, Buddhism does, every denomination within Christianity and so on and so forth has terms with this. So we might as well face up to the problems of the plurality of the divine world, if I may put it that way. So I think then, secondly, the second thing I wanted to say was, it's not just a question, it's not only that we're involved in trying to study other people's views, and that this is vitally important for understanding our plural world, but the very act of doing that is going to change us somewhat. That we hold up mirrors to others, and therefore we meet them. Every day we meet a good Christian, we meet a reflection of Christ, and therefore every time we meet a good Buddhist, we meet a reflection of the Buddha, and therefore the Buddha meets Christ, and Christ meets the Buddha. Which makes it, incidentally, one of the most exciting, creative periods in human history. I mentioned Gandhi before. Gandhi himself was a consequence of the meeting of Christianity with Hindu and other values. So the second thing then I want to say is that I do think this kind of study does tend towards a more tolerant, pluralist attitude as between religions. Doesn't, however, mean that we can't make judgments. The only thing is, it's difficult, more difficult than we thought, to make judgments. Finally, I just want to say a word, and then no doubt we can have some discussion. I just wanted to say, how would this work out from an educational point of view? I would wish, incidentally, our media did more in this respect of serious introduction to other people's beliefs. Our ignorance, the ignorance of most people, is very profound in these serious matters of what it is that moves the human race and has moved the human race. So it's important, I think, that the media should do more than they do. But apart from this, I'd like to see myself the subject, if we can call it that, of the study of worldviews and of religions as part of what occurs naturally in the high school context. But as I said before, it's dangerous to use the word religion, and it's better to use some other word. I'd like to see world history in schools anyway, as a normal requirement, and perhaps we can talk about spiritual or mental geography as the area that I'm concerned with. So I think that an educated person is somebody who, among other things, has some grasp of the variety of great religious and other traditions that animate human history. By that test, some of our leaders are, I fear, uneducated. I think it's reasonable to say, I don't want to enter too deeply into politics, but I think it's reasonable to say that if Henry Kissinger had had a clearer grasp of the nature of Shia Islam, some of American policy in the Middle East would have been different. But as it was, Henry Kissinger did not then, and probably does not now, have the foggiest idea as to what Shia Islam is actually about. And so it was that the Shah fell and a new regime arrived. So even from a practical point of view, I think it's important for the young people who go out of the schools of the Western world not only to understand computers, mathematics, and the economics of Adam Smith, but also the great living traditions of the world. Question, of course, it gets to the heart of the matter. As I said, experience seems to me very, central in religion, and you're talking about that, but that revelation is something that we experience, that I think is the view of many people in a number of religious traditions. Although there's also the question, of course, that traditionally people have identified revelation with propositions that are contained in books, and books are not experiences, though they may generate experiences. So there is a, shall we say, a kind of to and fro between external authority and one's own feeling. And I think that's important in a number of religious traditions. Obviously the Muslim feels the same about the Quran, that he knows the truth because the Quran contains revelation and also has its impact on him personally. I think that's a very notable feature of religious traditions. Buddhism too says, there is one phrase that's often used in Buddhism, that Buddhism is a come and see kind of religion. That is, you learn all the doctrines and all that stuff, but in the final analysis, it's your experience that gives you the truth. So I think that's something that could be generalized. But of course, behind your question or after your question, well, I think it's a good illustration. All we're doing is describing what people believe. But that very description itself raises a number of philosophical and theological questions. I think that's the end of the name. I think one of the important features of the Ayatollah Khomeini is that he has taken the Shia. He's actually everybody looks on him as very traditionalist. Actually, he's a revolutionary figure in his thinking, because he has taken the features of traditional Shia Islam, which I don't need to go into, but he's taken those certain traditional features and combined that with the idea of the modern state and suggested that there should be an Islamic Republic, as it's called. That's a combination of nationalism and modern statism on the one hand, and a certain features of the tradition. And he's combined those in a very powerful mixture. Now, many observers of Iran at the time when the Shah was tottering did not feel that traditional Islam could really overthrow the government. But of course it wasn't even traditional Islam, it was something that drew upon traditional Islam and mobilized it, but in quite a new direction, and it had dynamics which Western observers didn't really come to terms with, though they've now begun to come to terms with that. I think over here was next. In this country, well, I don't know. Of course, I have my particular life. I mean, I was just old enough to be drafted in World War II, so just at the end of World War II. As soon as I was drafted, the Germans collapsed. In terms of what's happened since the 1930s, there's been the Holocaust, but there's also been, of course, the terrible persecution of Buddhists throughout Asia in communist countries, and various other things. I think in the United States, in Europe, I don't think, you know, that seriously we could talk about much in the way of persecution in the post-war period, but I don't think that it's ever very far below the surface. As discussing with one of you earlier today about that, I don't know, he was saying that and I agree with that. I think that intolerance and persecution are never far below the surface, various kinds of racism and so on, unfortunately. I'll give an illustration of that, though it's far removed from religion in a way, but I went to visit in South Africa, and I met at a party, I met a whole lot of about 8 young English people and Welsh people who'd come out in the last few months in the gold mining business in Orange Free State. And with one exception, they were all instant supporters of apartheid in South Africa. They knew what it was like to be a black person, they knew, you know, how racists often have an exceedingly high opinion of their understanding of the mentality of inferiors. And so they knew exactly what it was like to be a black, and that was after just a few months. Well, the reason is, there's a lot of racism in Britain, but it's not respectable. But once you get outside Britain, then maybe it becomes respectable again. So I wouldn't say an increase, but I say it's still something that ought to be watched, and it's something I think that's important in our education, especially now with so many different racial and other ethnic and religious groups combining together in cities. But I'd say, of course, the United States has a remarkable record in melting pot and all that, and affirmative action and so on is very remarkable and really pretty much unparalleled in world history. But I think you've got to recognize when you look outside the United States that other countries are very different, because to a great extent the U.S. education system abolishes previous cultures and replaces them by a relatively homogeneous culture. That is not so in more traditional countries. The Druze. Well, actually the Druze are a distant offshoot of Shia Islam, in effect, who've had a very particular history in the mountains of Lebanon. So they're like their own ethnic group, somewhat regarded as pretty heretical by other Muslims. But I was just interested. I use that as an example because even I read the New York Times, which is supposed to contain nearly all the truth. And never once did I see any explanation of who a Druze was. And I just thought it's a funny thing. And, you know, every night on the news, people talk about the Druze and the Shia and all these guys who were shooting at the Marines, and everybody thought, isn't that interesting? But who were they? And why were they doing it? Yes, well, I think that the media could do more, as I said, and I think the newspapers could probably do more, but education could do more, too. So you better decide. Yeah. Oh, I think it's a tension in all religions at a certain phase, especially, and I think especially now, I think it's a big tension in a lot of Christianity. What about the mission field, in other words? I mean, after all, it's a little bit let me put it this way. Supposing what I said is true, there are noble Buddhists, then why send missionaries into Sri Lanka in order to convert them to something else? We no longer probably believe, I don't know, but I don't believe, the hymn of Bishop Heber, that very famous hymn, which goes from Greenland's icy mountains, etc. And it has one verse, what though the balmy breezes blow soft to a Ceylon's isle, which they later changed to Java's isle, because there were too many Anglicans in Ceylon, they didn't like it. But anyway, what though the balmy breezes blow soft to a Ceylon's isle, where every prospect pleases and only man is vile. Now, Bishop Heber was an Orthodox Christian of his time and thought that people in Sri Lanka and India and so on were plunged in sin and needed the light of the gospel. Now, it may be that they needed the light of the gospel, but were they plunged so deeply in despair is the question. And I think that does present a dilemma for missionary activity, and there's no doubt about it. I don't know that there's an easy solution to that question beyond this, which I heard somebody saying, I think, at the reception this evening, and that is, you should try to give people, if I'm correctly interpreting, accept the positive, but not the negative. That is, if you think that you have a pearl of great price, then share it with others. But that's rather different, a positive attitude, compared with simply tearing down what others may have. So I think that does, whether that's the final, whether that's a good solution or not, I don't know, but it seems to me the only way that I can see it.
Here, please.
Yes. Well, the question is, for those who didn't hear it, what about communism? Was I treating communism as a religion, and is it fruitful to treat communism as a kind of religion? And I would say, on balance, the answer is yes. That is to say, it has many of the characteristics of traditional religions, although it's anti-religious in its own mind. But what I mean is this, and this goes back, incidentally, to the presentation of the television ritual, the same sort of thing. If you're a Marxist, if you're a communist in the Soviet Union or Romania or somewhere, then there are certain doctrines you have to believe. You get taught those at school. That's ideological instruction at school. There's a certain narrative, the history. New things began at the revolution, everything was rotten beforehand, now everything, etc. You have an ethics, you've got to be a good Soviet citizen or whatever. You have rituals, but they're secular rituals, but they're still rituals, the May Day parade, the October Revolution parade, as in our own society, it's in Western world, often nationalism itself has this ritual kind of self-presentation. Often the two great orders of priesthood in the nationalism are more or less the same as they are in the Soviet system, and that is teachers and soldiers. One of the great symbols of hair on your chest, tanks and so forth, rockets going through the Red Square, well, that's all good ritual showing how mighty the Soviet Union is, the revolution's going to win, etc. And people are brought up to believe that it's full of ideals as well. One mustn't underestimate the idealism contained in traditional communism, and therefore, and people die for it. They die in battle for it. They sacrifice themselves more in the past than now. So, I think it's useful to look at it that way. And had the study of religion started, modern study of religion started in China, where they don't have the same concept of religion, they would probably have included communism. But the and also I'd say that we ought to, in this worldview analysis, let's analyze what the worldview is of the ordinary person in the Western world, who might be an agnostic or only believe in God occasionally, but believe in some kind of progress, in material values, in and so on, in science, and so on. These are often things that we must examine, and they function like religions for people. And many of them are open to criticism. Personally, I think the communist system and Marxism is very dangerous, and it's a great tragedy that that human history took the form that it did. So I'd like to argue against it and struggle against it, but yeah. Yes, yes, I think so. And I think you've got to reckon that those old men in the Politburo, some of them, perhaps all of them, believe in it, and sincerely, no doubt. They're not all just, you know. And one of the things that, I mean, if I was talking to President Reagan or Mrs. Thatcher or President Mitterrand, I'd say, why don't you spend, you know, 1 hour a week might be enough, just sitting down thinking, what's it like being Chernenko? You know, what would I believe if I were Chernenko? What would I think about Reagan if I was Chernenko? You know, the parable about the moat in your own eye, etc., might be useful. Well, I think myself that one of the major problems of the contemporary world is group identity. And this for a number of reasons, but one of them is that we have maybe some traditional identities, but the society around us is shifting all the time, and somehow it's easier, therefore, to lose a grip upon the meaning of one's life in a shifting environment, and therefore people are in search of identities, especially in a group. And if they're worried, then of course this may be a defensive way of belonging to a group, and therefore they're against softening up in relation to other groups. I mean, that is that you've got to take a hard line in order to maintain your own identity. I think that's one of the problems. That's particularly evident, of course, in people's struggles for the rights of ethnic groups, of minority groups throughout the world, that they their loyalty comes to some ethnic group and they wish to struggle against others. And that often leads to, on the one hand, revolutionary fighting by the underdog, and on the one hand, and on the other, oppression by the majority group. Christ, the one is called Christ at the center, isn't that right? No, I don't think so. I think personally that I did say in the second part that this very attempt to study other religions tends in the direction of tolerance and so on, and I think it does. On the other hand, I do myself want to make quite a strict distinction between what it is one believes as a private individual and what one does in the way of teaching professionally. I mean, I've been proudest often when people have been uncertain as to what my own belief is. I once was giving a talk on Buddhism in England, and some evangelical Christians came along, and they complained bitterly about how bad Buddhism was, and I started defending Buddhism. You know, it's not as bad as all that. You know, it's got many virtues, and every religion has its faults, but also its virtues, and so on and so forth. And afterwards, an Indian gentleman came up to me and said, "Are you a Mahayana Buddhist or a Theravada Buddhist?" And I thought, success. I'd got myself into the relevant Buddhist moccasins, not what they wear moccasins usually. So in a way, I think one must make a distinction between one's own private beliefs, and then they may be what they are. Now, some private beliefs don't go with the study of religion. I mean, there are some people, I think, who are so committed to their own religious tradition in a particular form that they find it difficult to exercise the necessary empathy for alternative positions. So it's partly a matter of character and various other things. As a private individual, I am by tradition and still by belief an Episcopalian, which is a very tolerant religion. But I've certainly been influenced by Buddhism, particularly, and to some extent Hinduism. I think one of the best expressions of Christian theology is to be found in one of the major Hindu writers, Ramanuja, who argues, you might like this, I don't know, who argues that the universe is God's body. And I think that's a rather nice way of expressing the relationship between God and the world. Anyway, lots of people wouldn't agree with me, but personally, I think I've learned something from that. So I think I've borrowed, if you like, things from my study, and I think it's fairly normal for people to do so, but it's certainly not a requirement of contract. You see, I think it's like a lot of other, obviously the study of anything, ideas that you think through and so on as part of your professional life abound themselves to have effects on your personality and your own personal conviction. Many people, of course, study religion because they're searching themselves primarily, and that's fine. But they shouldn't. But there can be dangers in that. There are some people that make religious studies into a new form of religion, which it can be in a certain way. So, I think one should avoid those pitfalls. But let's face it. I mean, if you were asked to go on a canoe trip up the Amazon and trek up the foothills of the Andes, afterwards you'd expect to be changed. If you could be changed by geographical motion, then you should be also changed by motion in the mind, moving across territories in the mind. I think it's bound to happen. Numerically, I don't know, because it's difficult to estimate some of them owing to lack of statistics, such as Buddhism. What does one say about Chinese Buddhism, which is not officially, well, only partially officially recognized. But I think it's true to say that the majority of religion at the present time is Christianity, and Islam is growing quite powerfully. I think they reckon that there will be something of the order of 2,000 nominal Muslims by the end of the century, and I've forgotten what the Christian figure would be, but something a little larger than that. But these statistics are not very helpful. And they say Britain is a Christian country. Well, all it means is if you go to somebody in the street and say, are you a Christian? They're too embarrassed. I mean, it'd be very embarrassing to say you weren't. If you say, of course, decent people are Christians. Well, no. Well, I certainly don't want to argue that a program of high school education in the study of world religions or spiritual geography is going to solve the world's problems. It's just a small contribution, I think, towards better attitudes, and they are in some areas, and for various reasons, in some ways they are better in certain parts of the world than they used to be. For whatever reason, I think there has been in some areas a growth of toleration, and I think it does often have to do with educational matters, though not exclusively, but that's one weapon, as it were, in the spread of it. But I would share a certain pessimism with you too, because I do think that we're to be plagued in the world by very considerable ethnic conflicts for the foreseeable future, somewhere or other, and they may indeed get worse. I think it works in both directions. Clearly, there are certain things more generally than American, just in capitalist society, which are very attractive if people can get their hands on them. I was recently in Singapore, for instance, which is a kind of model welfare society where everybody seems to have an apartment and a washing machine and so on. It's really a remarkable transformation from the time when I was there in the army. And it's the adoption by an Eastern population of a whole lot of Western matters and adaptation of material existence of a certain kind. And there's no doubt that American culture is a great magnet. But let's not forget that it's also the other way around. When I started in this business, so to say, of studying religions and languages and all that, it was unknown for... I was learning Chinese in the army. We used to sit in the London Underground reading Chinese newspapers. That caused a sensation. Then you'd begin reading out the football scores to your neighbour and they'd get even more surprised. But now Chinese culture had not had much impact on the West. But now there's all sorts of things like Tai Chi, acupuncture, in Indian civilization, yoga is everywhere, breathing, meditation, heaven knows what. These have permeated. Just look at the yellow pages of any American city and you'll find Swamis galore, though there's no heading for Swamis, but there's a whole lot of... it's going both ways, although I think American culture has proved so far the more dynamic. Nevertheless, also other cultures are influencing Western culture. And I think, therefore, that we're rapidly getting into a situation of going to have the beginnings of a world culture with subgroups of the different religions. And this goes back to the statistical question. Even the biggest religion will be in the minority. And we'll all be minorities of various cultural types within a single global system, and I think that does have an increasingly profound effect. Just to take one very small example, I was visiting an ostrich farm in South Africa, and I said to the girl who was showing us around the ostrich farm, how's business? She says, it's going to be terrific. I said, how do you know it's going to be terrific? She said, in yesterday's newspaper, there was a picture of Princess Di wearing a hat with an ostrich feather. So immediately, ostrich feathers sprout from Kalamazoo to Perth, Australia, throughout Japan and so on. So trivial events in one part of the world are beginning to affect other parts of the world. That, I think, so far is causing increasing understanding of other religious traditions. But there's a countervailing factor always. I sometimes ask people, why were the Iranians not hostile towards the Chinese? And the answer is, there weren't any Chinese in Iran. You only hate people that you can see, really. And you don't like too many foreigners. I mean, you know, it's the Iranians also thought, but many Iranians thought, American culture was itself a threat to traditional culture. So you then have the backlash phenomenon. So as well as whenever two cultures meet, I think you have beginnings of merging both ways, but you also have backlash phenomenon. And incidentally, that's true of religion too. One religion meets another, you get John Hick, as was mentioned over there, merging, but then you get conservative Christians saying down with Buddhism and conservative Buddhists saying down with Christianity. It polarizes a bit. I think that's also a phenomenon. Well, the second part is a bit a dangerous question. First part's pretty... I would like to say, of course, I haven't stressed this, that every religion obviously has its unique characteristics. So it isn't just a question of saying, you know, you find the same thing in different places. You find similar things, analogies. Of course, what is interesting to my mind, there are various things that are interesting to me in thinking about Mormon tradition. I mean, one is the fact that it's an American religion is important among a number of American religions, probably, you might say, the most successful. But secondly, of course, what is interesting, I think, comparatively, and it formed the basis of the conversation I was having earlier in a way, you do have the figure of the prophet. Now, prophetic experience in the modern world is by no means absent elsewhere than in the Mormon tradition, but it is something that brings, it reminds us that the notion of the prophet, which is so central a thing in the Old Testament, for instance, and in, of course, the rise of Islam, is also something which we find in the modern world, too. And so I think analysis of the concept of the figure of the prophet is something that interests me. I'm also interested, of course, in question of why it is that the Mormon tradition underwent a certain degree of persecution. I think it becomes a question. I'm really going to get myself into trouble, but allow me to sink deeper into the mire. Recently, about a year ago or two, I had to give testimony in a famous law case that was happening in London. I was a so-called expert witness on the definition of Christianity. I thought that sounds good. Why wasn't I one of the disciples, you know, the 12, if I could do that. Anyway, but they wanted a sort of view of how you'd look at it historically and so on. But it was in a case, a famous case in England, over the Unification Church, the Moonies, so-called. And I said that the question is, you see, there are two different ways in which you could approach the definition of Christianity. One is a value-laden approach, what you believe to be true Christianity. Another is a more descriptive historical approach, and I said the second, the descriptive historical approach, is the more fruitful. And by that test, then the Unification Church is a Christian body. It's rather the periphery of historical Christianity, but nevertheless, if they have connections with historical Christianity, they wish to be called Christians and so on. So descriptively, I include them in a history of Christianity. So then the lawyer on the other side, who was a former Attorney General of the United Kingdom and a lord to boot, a fearsome figure, he said, well, are there any other comparisons you could make? Is there any other group that you would say similar things about? And so I said, that's why I'm in trouble, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has a very similar history, in the sense that the majority of mainstream Christian bodies thought that it was heretical. But nevertheless, now it would, any history of Christianity of the United States, any serious history of Christianity, would include the Mormon tradition, obviously, I said. Well, that then the argument went on. In fact, there are several comparisons that can be made there. But it did raise in my own mind then some of the questions about why is it that, quote, mainstream churches are so fierce against the Unificationists, and why were they, and to some extent perhaps still are, against the Mormons? Interesting question, which I don't particularly have an answer, but it's something that needs to be resolved. Why is it that certain groups attract peculiar hostility? Of course, my trump card was this. I thought it was my trump card. That was, there is not a single major Christian denomination that has not been regarded as heretical or worse by all or some of the other major Christian denominations. So on that cheerful note, we lost the case.
Ah, there you are.